Welcome. I hope you're all enjoying the conference. I'm going to be talking about the client database statement request cache, the worst named feature in the product. Not only is it the worst name, it's completely misleading, because what you think it does based on what the name is not at all what it does.
Cool.
But it's an extremely useful feature. So how many of you have one of these?
How many know what it is?
How come everyone didn't raise their hand? You all have one.
But you got one.
So how many of you know what these do? I had no idea somebody had to tell me, because I couldn't.
It's a bottle opener.
Yeah, it's a bottle opener, but for beer.
Let's get beer.
Unfortunately.
Demo.
Demonstration.
We need volunteers.
Ah, yes, I should have brought some for a demonstration. All right. So how many of you have seen this message before? Pretty much everybody. So one of the things I'm going to talk about is how you can tell what caused this. Maybe. How about this? How many of you have seen this before?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so this happens to be an example of a deadlock amongst two users competing for resources. And so there are ways to detect what's causing these things, and that's the subject of our talk today. And there are several methods. So the client database statement request cache feature is one of them, but there are other things you can do as well. One of those is to generate 4GL stack traces on demand while your application is running. And the way you do that is by sending a signal to the 4GL runtime process that's executing 4GL code, which you can do on Unix or on Linux by kill-sig-user1 followed by the process ID. And that will cause a protrace file to be produced whenever you do that. And the application generates the protrace file and then it keeps going. And the information in the protrace file enables you to figure out roughly what the application is up to. So what you get in the protrace file, which strangely enough is named protrace followed by process ID, you get the startup parameters for that client, execution stack, so you get the 4GL stack, this procedure calls this procedure, calls this procedure, calls that procedure, and which files those are in. And the ProPath and the names of any persistent procedures that are active, and then information about the databases that are connected. So this is for 4GL clients, not for SQL, because the SQL doesn't execute 4GL code. And on Windows, you do this with the get stack command, because Windows doesn't have signals, so we've implemented that feature in a different way on Windows. So this got added in 10.1c, the ProGet stack. So if you're on a release earlier than that, you don't have this feature. How many of you are on a release that's older than 10.1c? A couple of you. Good. Good that it's not too many. Version 9 is still available and there's still people using it, but there aren't too many people in the progress development group who remember 9 anymore. Got short memory. Okay, so then there's the client database request statement cache feature, which is the bulk of what I'm going to talk about, which you can also use as a troubleshooting aid. So what does it do? It generates information about what your 4GL is, client is executing. So you can get several forms of trace information from it. And it'll tell you the line number, procedure name, and file name. And some more things for that. The Open Edge Data Management Database Administration book has information about how to use this feature. So you can find all the instructions there, but I'll give you enough instructions in the slide deck to that you won't have to actually go and read the document. Okay, so here's what the call stack looks like when you're looking at a 4GL stack trace. It's a last in, first out list, which means that the most recent thing that was called is first in the list. So here we have several procedures that have been called, starting at the bottom with the p72340_untitled1.ped. That's a scratch file that the editor, procedure editor, created. So most likely, in this example, somebody typed a run statement into the procedure editor and hit Control X. So the entire program is just that one line. And in that run statement, we call really long name internal procedure 0 in some program. And then at line 445 of that program, we call the next one really long named internal procedure 1, and so on. So line 5, we call the next one, and then we call the next one. And you can see the .r names alongside there. So you got a pretty good idea of exactly where your program is at the moment, or was when you got the trace generated. So when you send a SIGUSER1 to generate a ProTrace file, this is part of what's in there. But you can get the same information a couple of other ways, one of which is the client statement request cache mechanism, which what that does is the client sends this information to the database server. And the database server keeps hold of that and allows you to go look at it. So there's several different ways that you can turn on this feature. And you do it through Promon. So in the Promon R&D menus, you pick number 1, status displays, and then 18, client database request statement cache. And if somebody has a suggestion for a good name for this feature, please speak up. Anyway, so that's where you get to this menu, which is all of the stuff for controlling the database request statement cache. So there's 3 activation methods. You can activate it for individual users. You can activate it for all the users that are currently connected. And you can activate it for everybody that logs on after you turn it on. So the current set of users won't be affected, but anybody who logs in afterwards, the statement cache will be enabled for them.
Is it matter if the user is a self-service versus remote?
It does not matter if it's self-service or remote. This works for both. I'll talk later about a couple of differences between the two. Okay, and then there's three different activation types that you can enable. So the first one is a single or one shot. That means we get this information one time and then it's turned off. So you get one snapshot of what's going on, but it doesn't get updated continuously. And for the single case, you only get the name of the procedure that made the last database call. So you get the line number, the procedure name, and the .r name, where the last database call that that user made came from. Second choice is to send the whole stack frame. So you get the whole stack trace of procedure one, call procedure two, call procedure three, etc., to where the last database request came from. And there's a limit on the maximum size of this of 32K. And you can, this can be updated. So unlike the single shot case, this gets updated when the next database interaction occurs. You get a new stack trace. And then you can also get our single shot stack trace. So it gets sent one time, so you get a snapshot of where the program was, but it doesn't get updated, so it's turned off after we collect one set of stack frames. You can also do this for a server. So when you say you want to activate it for selected users, you get a list of users, and that list includes the servers. So if in there you pick a server, then this will get turned on for every user, every client that that server has, but not for the other clients or the other servers, unless you pick, turn them on separately. And also for app server agents, you can turn on tracing for them. But when you do that, what you're tracing is the activity that's occurring in the app server. There's no information about the app server's clients because it's the database server that's getting information about its clients. So the app server clients are one level removed from that, or maybe several levels removed from that. Anyway. And then you can also enable this feature for SQL servers and SQL clients, JDBC or ODBC clients. But when you do, you don't get ADL stack traces. What you get is the text of the last SQL statement that that client executed. Well, I forgot to mention also in the beginning, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt so we can deal with questions as we go. So the activation rules for SQL are the same as the activation types we have for 4GL. That is, you can get a single snapshot or you can get updated information each time the client interacts with the server. Okay, so now you turn this on, you collected a bunch of information, and you've gotten bored. And so how do you turn it off? Well, back in the same menu, there's choices for deactivating this tracing information. So you can turn off everybody or only some. And similar to the activate choices, one of them is turn it off for individual users. So let me pick from the list which ones I want to disable. And everybody, and leave it on for everybody who's currently connected, but don't turn it on for future. And then, again, when you pick server from the list that you get, you can deactivate all the clients for a particular server. Yeah?
If clients attach to multiple databases, this one only monitors the calls to the particular database that ProMod is attached to?
Correct. If you're looking at this menu in ProMod, you're looking at it for one database. And ProMod is looking at information on the server that your ProMod connection goes to. So you're seeing the server-side view through ProMod, and it doesn't know anything about any other databases that the client may be connected to. Okay, so now you got this data coming in, how do you look at it? So choice number 7 in the ProMod menu is view database request statement cache. And so that lets you look at the data that's been collected. There's another way to look at it as well, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So here's what the display looks like when you pick number 7 in ProMod. So you can see here we have user 5, 23, 24, 25, and 26. And some information about those clients, and then what type of monitoring we're doing for those. So you can see it says L1 blank, L2 RQ, L2. Those are which type of monitoring we're doing, and the blank one means we don't have any data from that client yet. It hasn't interacted with the database since we turned this on. So the monitoring has been activated for user 23, but he hasn't done anything. So maybe he's sitting in front of a screen waiting for the user to type something. So we haven't heard from him. Okay, so those different levels, what do they mean? So L1 means you're collecting the updated procedure name at the top of the stack only and not the entire stack. L2 means we're getting the complete stack, and RQ means we're getting a one-time stack. Now, why is this L1, L2, and RQ instead of L3? Or some other nomenclature that might make sense? I don't know. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a 32K byte data limit on the stack information. So if you have a really deep stack, you might not get all of it. But that's probably not an issue, because if you get like the top 10 stack frames and you're missing the bottom 3, you still can tell where you are, probably. Okay, so in case you're interested in the color coding scheme for resistors, I threw that in as well as reference information. I happen to need this information because I'm working on repairing an amplifier, so I thought I'd share. Okay, so if you're doing SQL, what does it look like? Well, so for SQL clients, we get the last SQL statement that was executed by the client. And this has a bit lower overhead than we have in the 4GL monitoring case. Because in the 4GL monitoring case, the 4GL client has to send the stack information over to the database server, and that's extra information that's not needed when we're not monitoring. But with SQL, the client is sending SQL statements to the server all the time. So we just save those and let you look at them. So there's no extra communication overhead in that case. But as I said, you're looking at SQL statements, not 4GL procedure names. And then, of course, there's no line numbers. Or done our file names either. So, when you start looking at the stack traces, this is the kind of information that's displayed here for a moment. So, here we have the line number followed by the procedure or function name, and then the .r file name, or the .p file name if it was a .p. And notice that the top line here, we have a procedure name, but we don't have one in the next line below. It says 4:user B/my.rs, but there's no procedure name, and that's because there wasn't any defined procedure. We were running in the main procedure in that piece of code, and it doesn't have a name. So if you're running OO code, then it tells you the method names from the class files that are being executed. Instead of procedure names, you see method names. But otherwise, it's fairly much the same. So the stack frames can include both of those types of codes that you can freely mix them in your application. Okay, so the first example I showed you of a stack trace, we had the bottom frame was a .ped file that was generated by the procedure editor. And of course, here it's line one, but if you typed 10 lines of 4GL into the procedure editor, it might be some other value besides line number one. All depends on what code you were running there. So there could be more lines than line number one. And of course, if you type that program into the procedure editor, that could have internal procedures in it that show up in the stack as well. Although people don't normally type very big programs into the procedure editor. And of course, a lot of you don't use the procedure editor because you're using the Open Edge Architect Eclipse-based development tools, but I don't use that. Okay, so sometimes you're going to see line number minus one. And there are various reasons for that. One of them is you have a piece of code that has an end statement at the end of a procedure, and there's a transaction boundary that's the same as the procedure boundary, and there's a bunch of database interaction going on inside of that, including automatically generated transaction commit at the end statement. That happens technically after the end statement's been executed. So you execute a procedure, hit the end statement at the bottom of it, it's the last line in the source file, and then after that, you get the transaction commit processing happening. So in that case, you get a minus one for the line number, because we're not actually running the 4GL code that's in the source anymore. We finished with that. There's a couple of places also where the situation is different. So you didn't fall off the end, but the action, database action that's occurring isn't attributable to a specific line number in an .p. And I can't think of a clean example of that right at the moment. That's another case where there's no specific line number associated with the action that's occurring, so we put it minus one in instead. Buffer flushing is an example of that, which happens automatically kind of outside of your control because the 4GL runtime does that automatically. So don't be surprised to see occasionally line number minus one. All right, now, there's some server-side caching that happens that doesn't happen in memory. So this feature creates scratch files on the server side to hold some of the information generated. The reason for that is there's a 32K limit on how big the stack frame listing can be. But if you have a system with 1,000 clients, that's an awful lot of 32K chunks. And so the client database statement request cache implementation uses some scratch files to store that information so that it doesn't fill up shared memory with that and cause your buffer pool to get smaller. Okay, so we create one of those for each database connection, and that happens once the call stack information gets exceeds 256 bytes. So we keep the first 256 bytes in memory, and anything more than that we write to a scratch file. And once those files get created, they hang around until the client disconnects. The default location for these files is in the same directory as the .db file. That is in the database home directory. You can change the location of this by using Perlmutt. So in the last choice, number 8 in that Perlmutt menu, allows you to specify a directory name where to put those files. Would have been nice to have a startup parameter, but we don't. So if you go and set the directory name after some scratch files have been created, only the new ones go there. The existing ones don't get moved. They stay where they are. So why would you want to change the directory name? Yeah.
Sorry, is there plans to add a startup parameter?
There what?
Is there plans to add a startup parameter? That's no.
Well, the truth of the matter is the database guys have been working on table partitioning. They don't do anything else until they finish that project. So we're nearing the end of that project, which means now we're going to go through a planning cycle. So you should go to the database info exchange and tell them to add that parameter. Because now is the right time to be asking for things, because it's the beginning of a new cycle. So in the next cycle, we'll do some more work on table partitioning, but there will be capacity to do other stuff. Adam, yes?
They could go to communities. It's been an idea.
Yes, you can go to communities and submit an idea. I hate that. The fact that they call it ideas, I think that's an unfortunate choice of names for that. But you, as you pointed out, you can go there and submit an ID. Okay, so the file names are, they end with .cst for client statement, which is not what's in there. And they have these encrypted names that you have no choice over. You only have a choice over in the directory. But it doesn't matter, because you don't actually need to look inside of these files. Okay, so you can do this for app server agents as well, not just clients, 4GL clients, underscore progress, or ProWin32 clients. You can do it for the app server agents as well. So you can see what actions the app server is making. Okay. There's another way to look at this information besides in the menus in Promon. You can also use virtual system tables to read these. So there's a underscore connect caching type, which tells you what type of caching information is being collected. There's underscore connect cache info type, which tells you the, so the caching type tells you the level, 0, 1, 2, or 3, instead of L1, L2, RQ, which we saw in the Promon screen. Consistency was just too hard, so we have different labels here for the same information. And then the connect cache info type tells you the type of cache monitoring that you're doing. And in there you get a unknown value for that if we haven't gotten any information yet. So if there's no information available, you saw a blank in the other screen on Promon, and here you get a unknown value. In that case. And then there's the program name, the stack, and the SQL statement information. Then there's the, all this, by the way, is in the underscore connect VST. I should have mentioned that. These are all the different fields related to this that are in underscore connect. So this information is there for each database connection that where when this feature is enabled. So the last update timestamp is there, so you can tell how old the information is. Then there's the stack entries themselves and the line numbers that correspond to that. So there's up to 32 stack entries with a procedure name and .r or .r, procedure name .p or .r for each one. And then the corresponding line numbers, up to 32 of those too. So now when you look at this information, do queries, you can do a for each underscore connect. And if you do underscore connect caching type not equal to unknown, that's not going to work. And the reason for that is when you ask for a, yes?
Can you tell monitoring on through VSTs?
Can you turn monitoring on through VSTs? No, you have to do it through Promon. So this first query doesn't work, and the reason is because the caching type gets turned back to unknown if you said single shot. So you get the procedure name of the last database request, and then the monitor gets turned off, so you get unknown in there after you've gotten some data. So the right way to do this is to look at the cache info type, not the caching type. And it tests that for unknown to see if you have any data. And then there's a display statement there that illustrates how to look at the other data. So it's pretty straightforward to look at. Now, when you do it this way, instead of using ProMod, what you're doing is using a 4GL client to read the underscore VST, underscore connect VST, so you're doing generating database activity to go retrieve this information from the client. And of course, if you're doing it across a network connection, it's going to generate network traffic. No surprise there. The point is that the monitoring activity can introduce some overhead. And looking at the data introduces some overhead too. There's a slide here that talks about row numbering because we have this difference in numbering schemes between various things that the VSTs can look at. So connection IDs and user IDs are off by one. So if you're looking at this data, make sure you do that right. Okay, so how much memory is this all going to take? Because we're collecting data in shared memory on the server side. Well, so the static allocation is 28 bytes per client. And then there's a dynamic allocation, 288 bytes per user that we're collecting data for. That gets allocated once the client sends information to the server. So the static allocation is information that tells us, okay, monitoring's been enabled and it's this type of monitoring. And then the dynamic allocation is where we keep the data that we've collected. So that's 288 bytes per user. And that goes in shared memory. And that gets allocated from shared memory along with all the other stuff. And of course, this could change from release to release because we often change the size of data structures when we're making enhancements or other changes. So take 288 with a grain of salt. Okay, so.
But effectively, on most systems, an insignificant amount of memory.
Well, that depends. If you got 5,000 users, it maybe is slightly more significant. But it's still not a lot. Actually, the worst case is you're right at the limit of your 32-bit address space because you're running a 32-bit version, and you add one more thing to shared memory and it doesn't fit anymore, so you're 3 bytes over the limit. If that happens, you'll get a error about being able to allocate shared memory. I forget what the error number is, but then your only alternative is make something else smaller so this will fit. Or use a 64-bit version, but everybody hasn't switched over to that yet, but you should the first chance you get. All right, so what happens performance-wise? Let's take a look at that. So we have this information that's being sent by the clients to the server, and if it's a network client, so the client's connected to the server by TCP/IP, then this information is piggybacked on your database request. So if you do a find next, there's a message that gets sent to the server that says find next for whatever table you're doing that operation on. And then we add the stack information to that message. So it piggybacks on the database request that we send. So that happens on database changes. So creates, deletes, updates, and find requests. Also lock requests. So basically any database request that we send over has that information. And so that could be a noticeable increase in how much data goes over the network. So if you're on a crappy network, you'll see an impact on performance. If you're using shared memory clients, then that information is not sent over the network, so the overhead is much less. And if you're using Promon to look at the data, then there's no network traffic because of that either. But if you do it, if you retrieve the data over VSTs, like I showed you from the underscore connect table, then of course there's extra overhead in that. Okay, so there's this dash MM startup parameter, which specifies what the maximum network message size is that we use. So this extra information, of course, comes out of that. So if you set dash MM to 2K, let's say, when you enable this feature, that means there's less room for database request information because we're putting this stack information in there. And if the stack is very large, it may take multiple messages to send the stack frames over. So you may see an increase in messages, the number of messages from that. Then, of course, if that happens, you can increase dash MM. But you have to do that on both sides, the database and the client have to be started up with the same dash MM value. Okay, so performance. If you're collecting single snapshots of information that's not being updated with every database request, the performance impact is going to be insignificant. But if you're collecting full stack frames every operation, it's going to be noticeable. And I have some data to answer the question, how noticeable? So, so this chart, you can see it has shallow versus deep. So shallow means I'm only collecting the topmost procedure name and not the entire stack. And deep means I'm collecting the whole stack. So the leftmost column there is percentage overhead that's added onto a normal database request when you do this. And you can see there's two versions of over the network. One with the default MM parameter setting and one with the dash MM set to 8K. You can see that it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, the network buffer size. But you may see different behavior on different networks as well. These experiments were run on the land in Bedford. You might, for example, see different results if you're on a WAN as opposed to a fast LAN. You can also see here that the overhead for self-service is smaller than the overhead for network clients.
Sorry, guys.
Yes.
So Sorry, I didn't catch what the overhead percentage numbers were measuring.
Well, they're measuring performance throughput. So, take the rightmost column here in the chart. It's almost 25% reduction in throughput, or put it another way, the request is taking 25% longer to process. And of course, your mileage may vary, depends on the application, transportation, meals, and accommodations not included. So take the 25% with a grain of salt. This test that we were running for this was banging on the database pretty hard. We were kind of trying to make a worst case test here to measure that.
Why is the shallow cell less deep cell less than shallow cell?
We don't know.
Okay. Well, I thought it might be greater.
Well, they're not that different actually. You're right, the shallow is larger than the deep self, but it's a small difference. But we don't know why it's different. We weren't able to figure that out. All right, so back to the beginning. So when you get a deadlock, what do? Well, you got several choices. So here in this deadlock situation, we have user one waiting for user two, user two waiting for user one to release an exclusive lock. So most likely what's happened here is that they're trying to upgrade a share lock to exclusive or something. In this case, they're trying to acquire a share lock, but the other one has an exclusive on the same record. But you get the same kind of deadlocks with upgrade requests as well. Anyway, so once this happens, these two clients will block and sit here until the lock wait timeout causes one of them to give up, and then the other one will succeed in getting the lock. So the question is, how do you detect where this is happening in the application? Well, if the statement cache is active, you can go look at where the two programs are. So you might find, well, one of them is in x2.p doing a find orders, and the other one is doing a find customers in a different program, and then you can go look at those two programs and see what's happening there, so it's pretty easy to detect this kind of situation. If you don't have statement caching enabled, then what do? Well, you can turn it on and wait for it to happen again. Or you can generate a protrace. So you can do kill sig user one or pro get stack to get the RGL stack for these two users. Because in ProMine you can find out which users they are by looking at the lock table or the block clients, various places where that information shows up. So when you generate the stack trace.
Yeah, you said that they could use a pro trace after the fact?
Well, if they're stuck, okay.
Oh, they're still stuck.
If they're blocked, so they're sitting there waiting for each other, you can generate a pro trace, and it will show you where those two users are in the application.
So you generate the protrace by killing the user?
Well, you're not actually killing them. It happens that the command you use is kill, but it's not really. It's going to send a sig user one signal to the client, and we have a signal handler that catches that notification and says, oh, time to generate a protrace file. So it creates a protrace file and then continues.
So I still would be sitting there, Tom, and then you go do your eeny, mighty, mo, and disconnect one of those two dead lock users.
Yeah, or you can wait for the lock wait timeout to do it for you.
Where did the, do you know when the kill sig user one, what version of progress that was enabled?
That's been available for quite a long time, so it might have been version 8 that we put that in. I don't remember.
Quite a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
Where does it create the protrace in the current directory in, or is it
work directory?
It creates it in whatever directory the process is currently in, which is typically the work directory, but doesn't have to be, because your client could execute some code that changes the directory to some other place. But it's usually the work directory.
If you're in Unix, you can run lsof and look for a client work directory, and that's where your protrace will be.
Yeah.
So if you run a script to automate all this, you just pull that out of the lsof command, and that'll tell you where your protrace file is.
Yep.
I'm still
there.
Okay, if you start a protrace at the beginning of your session so that you can trace?
No, protrace is when you need one.
Okay, and you start that at the beginning of
a
session.
No. Yeah. Protrace is a one-time event.
Right.
The when you send a pro get stack command, that gives you the stack one time in a protrace file.
Ah.
Snapshot.
It's a snapshot. At the time that when you type in the pro get stack command, that's when the
okay.
information gets collected, and it just happens each time you use that command.
Okay.
The client monitoring thing, that can produce updated information if you pick the right option when you enable it. So you can enable that for the session. And it'll keep going until you tell it to stop.
Right, and that's what I'm used to.
Okay. So, moving on. So the lock table overflow situation, what do you do? Okay, so if you look at the lock request by user in Promon, here we have user 6 has 3,213 locks, compared to only a few in the other two users. So what that's telling us is that user 6 is using a lot of locks. So why is he using a lot of locks? Well, we don't know. Let's go find out. So if you enable the statement cache, then you'll find out where that user's executing in the application, or if you generate a protrace file, then you can find out what part of the application is running and go look at the code and figure out why it's using all those locks. Maybe it's doing a query that's bigger than it needs to be. It's retrieving more data than it should. Or if the code is encrypted, no. You have to have, well, you can get the stack trace from encrypted code, but you can't go look at it anymore.
Gus?
Yes?
There's no timestamp information in any of this, is there?
Yes, there is.
For each particular line at this time?
There's no timestamp for each stack frame, but there's a timestamp for when the data got sent to the server or when the last database request was made. So if you enable tracing for a single snapshot, it records the timestamp when that was received. And if it's in update mode, so it's getting refreshed over and over, then the timestamp you see is the last one.
Okay, you don't see the timestamp of each one, only of the last one.
Correct. Yeah. Okay, so this is easy, fast, cheap, and underutilized. Not enough people know about this feature. It's very handy for when you get into troubleshooting and trying to figure out why applications are misbehaving. As I said, there's some overhead which you have to pay attention to, but probably don't have to worry about it too much unless you have a really big system and you enable it for every user. That might be noticeable. Yeah.
Just a comment for those people here who use the code top from Master School, that has the ability to display this call stack information for users, for a single user, or for all the users who have it enabled, and also lets you turn it on and off in the tool.
So who uses ProTop here? It's an excellent tool. I encourage you to use it. Okay, I'm done. Questions? When the server receives the SQL statement before it starts processing. Yeah, Dan?
Did you mention the bugs that I...
I did not mention bugs.
There's a couple of bugs in there that I ran into at a customer site that I personally would be a little wary of using it on anything less than 10.2e08 with a hotfix and 11.3 with a hotfix. Based on clients' experience, that I encouraged them to turn it on, and unfortunately, it didn't work out well for us.
Okay, so make sure you get the bug fixed before you put this on in production. Another piece of advice is before you do this in a production system, practice in a test system, just so you know how to understand how to work it. Yeah.
Is there any way to correlate this information with underscore user table stat information?
Is there any way to correlate this with underscore user table stat information? Not in any easy way.
You can look at like the user IO, and when you've got a user that's got DB access is going crazy, you can fire off one of your SIG kill user blah 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 to generate a protrace to see what they're doing. We have various things that we look for, and when users start misbehaving, like they start acquiring too many locks or they start going crazy with reads or they are in a queue lock with somebody else, we just start firing off these signals and generate protrace. The protrace is a pin to each other, and so you can generate 5 or 6 or 10 or
yeah, that's true.
It works really, really well.
There's a variety of other information available that you can use to determine if some user is misbehaving. And then you can start collecting information about what that user is doing. But the simple situation of I'm collecting user table stats, so I turn that on when I start up the database, and then I turn on client statement monitoring, and so I start collecting that information. There's no easy way to correlate those two by themselves. Other questions? Okay, we're done. Thank you very much.